Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved with 170 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC, and she's a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. Anthony Fauci, an internationally recognized expert in AIDS research. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about advances in the use of mobile ultrasound technology. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Mark Maselli.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on song, something at the heart of all cultures and a powerful tool that can be used to convey crucial healthcare information. In the West, we receive the majority of our health information in writing. But in many third world countries, where the illiteracy rate is high, health officials and community organizers are responding with something most anybody can understand, song. In Cambodia, for example, many wells and rivers are contaminated. A group called Resource Development International is teaching locals about water safety with karaoke videos. Trucks carrying karaoke equipment arrive in villages where adults and children gather to sing along to videos. In this song, they are singing about arsenic poisoning in the wells. The lyrics are saying that the water educator has come to test all the wells for arsenic in the village. If the well is painted green, that means that the water is safe to drink. But if the well is painted red, that means it's contaminated with arsenic and should not be used for drinking. In Mali, where more than 800,000 people are infected with malaria, a song about prevention, sung by local musicians, has been playing on the radio. The song urges people to use insecticide-treated nets. After the campaign ended in 2007, a survey found that 81% of all households had nets, as opposed to 29% just a year earlier. Singers in Western India have been using street theater to educate mothers about immunization, breastfeeding, and newborn care. In these song lyrics, the message is about the power and strength of breastfeeding. Specifically, they are saying breastfeeding protects the child from disease and should be done until the child is 2 years old. The project began in 2004, and after the first 5 years, researchers found that immunization of children in Western India ages 12 months to 23 months rose from 48% to 78%. Not only is song a way to get a message across, but throughout history, it has proven to be an effective way to learn and retain information. Singing public health care messages to save lives in developing countries? Now that's a bright idea. Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease at the National Institute of Health, and one of the leading AIDS researchers in the world. Welcome, Dr. Fauci.
It's good to be here.
Tell me what it means today for a person who receives a diagnosis of HIV. What's their prognosis? And compare that, if you will, to what it meant 30 years ago when the first case of HIV was identified.
Well, it really is a stark contrast from 30 years ago, and I can remember very clearly in patients that I saw in the very early years, in the early 1980s, who would come to our hospital, and usually by that time they had advanced disease, that the median survival for those individuals would be measured in several months, somewhere between 6 and 8 months. 30 years later, today, with the drugs that we have used in combination, for example, if a 20-year-old would come into the clinic with a newly diagnosed HIV infection and you put that person on appropriate combination therapies that we know have been life-saving, that person, you can mathematically project that that person will live an additional 50 years. Wow. So the difference is just extraordinary between what it was 30 years ago.
And Dr. Fauci, the first decades of your work, of course, focused on what was happening right here in the United States and all across our country. Now, of course, a global focus on HIV/AIDS and bringing the benefits of the research and the development and the treatments to all countries, especially those with really severely restricted resources. And you've been key to this effort. I know you've been instrumental since President Bush's creation of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Maybe you could share with us, what is the current state of the global effort, and maybe both in affluent or developed countries and those that are really undeveloped and lacking in those resources?
Well, if, for example, in the developed world, starting there, even though the epidemics are under reasonably good control, they are still extremely serious. And the United States could be a good example. So far, we've had now about 600,000 deaths. There are about 1.1 million people currently infected with HIV, 20% of whom do not know they're infected. And that's a real problem, because those are the people who inadvertently, about half to 60% of the new infections are transmitted by people who do not know that they're infected. We have about 56,000 new infections each year in the United States. That's completely unacceptable in the year 2011, when we know how to prevent the transmission of HIV. So we still have a long way to go in getting prevention modalities, getting into the community, getting people tested, and getting them on therapy. In the developing world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, it really still is an extraordinary problem, a disastrous problem. There are worldwide about 34 million people living with HIV infection and about 2.6 million new infections each year. Of the global distribution, about 90% of the infections are in the developing world, about 67% in sub-Saharan Africa. What has happened over the last few years, particularly over the last 8 years or so, 7 or 8 years, with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the Global Fund, is that individuals in the developing world who had no chance of getting prevention or treatment or care modalities are now having a greater access to that, such that now there are about 6.7 million people worldwide on therapy. That's the good news. The sobering news is that only really encompasses about 40% of the people who actually need therapy. And for every person we put on therapy, 2 to 3 people get newly infected, mostly in the developing world. So we have a long way to go. We've come an enormously long way, both in prevention and in treatment, but the challenges ahead are still formidable.
Dr. Fauci, in responding to epidemics, humanity has the ability both to learn from the past and provide models, good and bad, for the future. As you look back over the past 30 years' battle in fighting AIDS, aside from the stigma associated with AIDS, were there other issues that got in the way of an effective response to the epidemic? And what have we learned for the next challenge?
Well, what we've learned is that people do not really appreciate the facts as they unroll. Most of the time in countries in which there was a problem and is a problem, and there weren't a lot of infections that were noted, there was the assumption, oh, it's not going to be our problem. It's going to be some other country's problem. It started off with, oh, it's only gay men in the United States and the developed world. And then, well, no, not really. There's injection drug users. And then when it became very apparent to us that this was not a Western world disease, but was a disease of the developing world, heterosexual transmissibility is the major modality of transmission worldwide. And it was a lack of appreciation as these things were unfolding that in a disease that's sexually transmitted, that's a virus that can kill you, there's a really very foolish, not prudent at all to believe that a country or a people or a region is going to be exempt from this type of thing. So even though we knew this was really a problem in the early 80s, there wasn't that mass mobilization globally to prevent infection and to educate people about infection. And that's why right now it's a terrible global problem.
And if I can pick up on some of these threads, I certainly think that stigma and discrimination against persons with AIDS or persons who might have AIDS was so strong in the early days of the epidemic, and I think that's gotten much better. But we still face the reality, and I often hear it presented this way, that as many as a third of infected people in the U.S. aren't aware that they are infected. And that's despite years of recommending first testing for people in risk groups, then recommending routine testing, providers being trained to that. What's getting in the way, do you think, in the United States, especially where we have access to testing? Is it provider resistance? Is it still denial and fear, or just really lack of understanding that people are at risk for this infection?
It's a combination of that. Because if you look in the United States, you have the correct number is about 20%, 21% of the 1.1 million people who are infected don't know they're infected. So if you look at the United States, which has a population of 12% of people in the United States are African American, about 50% of the new infections are in the African American population. These are individuals as a group that have less access to health care, that are living in regions and in places and locations which there's injection drug use. There's all of the health issues that relate to economic deprivation. And now you're talking broadly as a group, obviously, that you can't take any individual or any particular place and say that this is where everybody is in that category. But as a group, African Americans don't have as good access to medical care, to the counseling that you can get from medical care. And also, within the African American community, there's less of a tolerance of homosexuality, of being a gay person. There's a major stigma in the African American population among themselves about gay men and homosexuality, much less so in the white population in the United States. So there's a double disadvantage, is lack of access to a healthcare system and a considerable amount of stigma that has prevented the access into that group of individuals to get them counseled and get them tested. In fact, a major effort is going on right now to seek out in those communities that that have a higher incidence and prevalence of infection, to get to individuals, get them tested, and linking them to care, because it happens sometimes that you actually get somebody tested, but they don't have a healthcare system to link to, so they go ahead and are infected and don't even know it because they never come back for the follow-up result of their test. So there are many reasons why we still have this problem.
This is Conversations on Healthcare Today. We're speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. He's been involved in the fight against HIV/AIDS since its beginning 30 years ago. You know, activism has played a huge role in the fight against HIV and AIDS in this country. Can you tell us a little bit about the role of activism in the battle against AIDS? And what's your relationship been with the activist community? And how have they influenced policy in the implementation of science and otherwise?
Well, in the AIDS story in the United States, the role of activism has been extraordinarily important. It has been very, very positive from the very early days of gaining the attention of the general public, of the scientific community, of the regulatory authorities. The activists, and at that time mostly gay activists, played a major role in improving the situation and getting funding for the research endeavor, in getting clinical trials to be designed to be user-friendly so that people can more easily get into the trial, to loosen up and make more flexible the regulatory system to approve drugs more rapidly, particularly when you have what was then a uniformly fatal disease, which now, thankfully, with the drugs that we have, that's not the case. So the role and the impact of activism has been extremely positive. I developed early on in the 80s a very good relationship with the activists, because I took the time early on to, despite their confrontation, despite the fact that they were very iconoclastic and disruptive to gain attention, appropriately so, if you listen to what they were saying, it made perfect sense. If you read what they wrote, it made perfect sense. So very early on in the 80s, I developed a relationship, a collaborative relationship with the activist community, to the point where they are now a major part of our advisory groups, our ad hoc working groups, our councils. They're involved at every level of the AIDS endeavor, in the scientific, regulatory, and otherwise. So it's really a classic example of the important positive impact of activism on a very important disease like HIV/AIDS.
And Dr. Fauci, along with that activism, certainly the development of effective drug treatment has been such a game changer, but still very hard to get the drugs distributed and taken correctly in areas where there's limited infrastructure. And you know, we read and talk a lot with people who are involved in new technologies, particularly using mobile health technology overseas, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, to remind people about treatment. Also, though, to train local health workers, to give advice and consult to local health workers. What are you seeing in the effectiveness of these innovations globally? Is this something that's really going to help us in the worldwide fight against AIDS?
It's working. It's actually working. There was a presumption, incorrect presumption early on, that you couldn't get people in the developing world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, to take their medications every day. You couldn't get them to come in and get tested or followed up. And that has proven to be absolutely false and incorrect. Because right now, particularly with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the Global Fund and the Gates Foundation and other groups that are right there in the trenches delivering prevention, treatment, and care in the developing world, it is doable and it is much more successful than people had assumed incorrectly.
Dr. Fauci, I want you to pull the thread for us a little. Could you paint us a picture of the best and worst case scenarios of the progress of the HIV disease over the next 10 years? What would it look like and what would be some of the key turning points?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because we are at a critical point right now. There had been a recent study, literally just a few weeks ago, that showed that if you treat the infected partner of a couple in which one person was infected with HIV and the other was uninfected, and you treated the infected person for their infection earlier rather than later, in other words, earlier than what the regular guidelines are, that not only is it good for the patient who's infected, but you have a major positive impact in preventing that person from transmitting the infection to their uninfected partner. It is what we call treatment as prevention. The reason that's important is that there's a big push now globally to both prevent infection and treat infection. There's limited resources. We have now at our disposal all of the capabilities to have a major, major impact on slowing down and ultimately ending the AIDS pandemic. The big game changer obviously will be when we have a vaccine, which we don't have right now, but even without a vaccine, we can have a major impact on slowing down this epidemic. The issue is it's very, very much demanding on resources. Mm-hmm. And although billions and billions of dollars have put in, now with the constraints economically, globally, there isn't enough resources to meet the need and the demand. And that's exactly what is the challenge that we're facing with. In fact, we had a big, important, high-level meeting at the United Nations a couple of weeks ago in which this particular issue was discussed in great detail. Now is the time, if you invest billions now, more than we're doing, you will save many billions years from now by preventing infections, by treating people and giving them access to prevention modalities. So when you talk about best and worst case scenarios, the best case scenario is if we get the resources and utilize them now, we could really turn around the epidemic. The worst case scenario is if we don't do that and 2.6 million people continue to get infected each year, so that the burden and the needs of treatment will accelerate rather than decrease over the next few years. That's the worst case scenario.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. He's been at the front line of the fight against HIV/AIDS since it began just over 30 years ago. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
You're quite welcome. It's my pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare brings you Healthy Technology, a look at how technology is improving healthcare. I'm Lauren Bonner. The Columbia Basin in Washington State is one of the most agriculturally diverse regions of the United States. The long, warm summer days, cool nights, and mineral-rich soil make it ideal for growing tree fruits, wine and juice grapes, mint, asparagus, potatoes, and dairy. Many residents in this rural area of eastern Washington are seasonal and migrant farm workers. Getting to health centers is a major challenge for many of them.
Because we're rural, transportation is an issue. There is no public transportation. So we always are looking for some ways to provide quality care that is accessible.
That's Greg Brandenburg, CEO of the Columbia Basin Health Association. They provide care to around 30,000 patients, half of whom are migrant workers. Recently, they've been able to get health care to more patients because they have been able to bring it to the patients. For about a year, Columbia Basin has been a test site for a new mobile ultrasound device called Mobius, created by the Redmond, Washington-based Mobisante, Inc. On the surface, the device is a standard smartphone. For it to work as a mobile ultrasound device, developers built a transducer that could be attached to the smartphone and specialized software to create a very functional, powerful machine. U.S. academic centers, emergency departments, and community clinics have been testing the device. Some have actually implemented it since it received FDA clearance. In fact, it was the first cell phone-based diagnostic device to be cleared by the FDA. But Shatani says a device like this has the potential to have an even greater impact outside the industrialized world. Developing countries are often deprived of healthcare resources, but cell phones are nearly everywhere, and 90% of the world lives today within the reach of a cell phone signal. He says this device addresses a much more fundamental imperative for the developing world.
They don't have enough doctors or hospitals to provide coverage or any kind of healthcare, right? So they have to essentially rely on mid-level professionals to be their frontline healthcare workers. The problem is, in order for these people to provide care, they need diagnostic devices like ours. I mean, you need to create the kind of devices that are simple, that are inexpensive, that are sufficiently rugged to be used in the field.
The fact that the device can transmit its data as a cell phone is an important point to consider for its far-reaching impact. The connectivity aspect means mid-level professionals can be trained to carry out the work. They can send the images somewhere else for interpretation or a second opinion. Chaitali Sinha, Program Officer on Research on Health Equity with the International Development Research Center, IDRC, in Ottawa, Ontario, says this has to go hand in hand with new mobile health technologies that will be appearing on the market.
It's all about this cyclical idea of not getting too wrapped up in the actual technologies, but making sure that you are being one step ahead and trying to innovate in ways that are most helpful to those that you're actually trying to help.
Shatani's long-term vision seems to fit right into this statement.
These will be handheld, powerful devices that you're taking to the patients. And as you're collecting data from the patients, you're getting real-time information on what's happening to populations at large. And as you bring the data to the cloud, you can start to see patterns on what is happening to the populations. And then that gives you a very, very powerful mechanism. And I think that's where connectivity truly becomes meaningful and powerful.
Right now, the focus for Shatani and his company is to increase providing inexpensive diagnostic imaging that can save lives right away.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of connecting our communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.